In terms of the global reach of film, Chaplin is really the first major star of the cinema.
Theater owners at the time indicated that all they had to do was put a silhouette of him with his bowler hat and his cane and his feet in front of the theater, and people would queue up.
His stardom is kind of a remarkable phenomenon. He was the Elvis or the Beatles of his day.
In these days of devalued celebrity, it's hard to imagine just how famous Charlie Chaplin was. We all know his films, Modern Times, The Gold Rush, The Great Dictator, Limelight, but it was Chaplin's personal status as an immediately recognisable icon which made him perhaps the world's first superstar. Starting out in music hall, Chaplin's ascent to fame mirrored the rise of cinema itself, a new medium which allowed images to be projected all around the globe, creating for the first time the phenomenon of worldwide performance. 30 years after his death, Chaplin's cultural impact still reverberates around the globe, spawning Chaplin impersonators in Bombay, inspiring a line of Belgian clothing based on his Little Tramp outfit, and providing soundbite samples from The Great Dictator for the modern musicians of the 21st century.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people.
Elvis may have wanted to be James Dean, but the tradition of his pelvis-wiggling superstardom has its roots in the bandy legs, splay feet and waggling moustache of Chaplin. Like so many modern film critics, I spent years dismissing Chaplin's work as overly sentimental, a soft-hearted comedy of pathos which lacked the cutting edge of Buster Keaton. But there's nothing soft about the effect that Chaplin and his extraordinarily physical comedy had upon a range of radical artists, modernists, surrealists, Dadaists, even the Russian avant-garde. For this programme, we've been granted privileged access to Chaplin's personal and professional archive, housed in Montreux, Bologna and Paris. Here's Charlie's son Michael in the Montreux archive, sifting through hundreds of newspaper cuttings that cover every part of Chaplin's life, from his scandalous divorce cases to early billboard advertisements of his new films.
In America, the Keystone Company advertised, "Are you prepared for the Chaplin boom? There has never been so instantaneous a hit as that of Chaz Chaplin, the famous carnal comedian in Keystone comedies. Most first-rank exhibitors have booked every film in which he appears, and after the first releases, there is certain to be a big rush for copies."
Chaplin's Little Tramp figure, with his trademark bowler hat and cane, certainly had found immediate favour with cinema audiences, striking a popular chord around the world. So widely embraced did this persona become that any of its constituent physical parts, the legs, the feet, the moustache, swiftly became identifiable as universal shorthand for that distinctive Chaplin charm. In the ensuing years, avant-garde artists would shatter and deconstruct these individual elements, rearranging them to produce infinitely varied and increasingly modern portraits of Chaplin. But Charlie himself believed that the key to his success lay in his everyman persona, in the Ordinary Joe underdog role which he came to champion and in which his audiences could see reflections of themselves. For Chaplin, this personality was always more important than the particular story in which it was found.
Nothing can transcend human personality. You know, a story is all secondary, is purely a background in which this precious thing called personality functions. That's my belief. That's my concept of pictures. The idea of getting somebody that has personality, distinction, somebody that the people can look at and identify themselves with.
By 1915, Chaplin's global personality was already well established, thanks to a series of short films made with the Keystone Company. But Charlie's plans for independence had been mapped out long before, dating right back to the days of his work in Vaudeville Review. Browsing through the Paris collection with archive director Kate Guillaume Vache, we found two letters which Charlie wrote to his brother Sidney on the very eve of his success. Letters which indicate an extraordinary awareness of what was to come, both for himself and for the emergent medium of film.
He didn't write letters very often. This letter was written to Sidney Chaplin, his brother, when he's in the States on this tour with Fred Karno in the Vaudeville. Yeah. And he says, "Just think, Sid, I think it's $35 a week or something, is not to be laughed at, and I only want to work about 5 years at that, and then we are independent for life. I shall save like a son of a gun." And then there's another letter, exactly a year later, which is in August 1914. So he's been with Keystone Films for 8 months. And he writes to his brother again and says, "I've got great news. Max Sennett of Keystone has a job for you. He wants you to come and act. And it's really brilliant because then you'll get your fare paid. So you can come to the States, and that's wonderful. But for heaven's sake, when you sign, don't sign for a long period of time. A year will be quite enough because I want you with me when I start." So he knows, within 6 months of being in the cinema and making films for Keystone, he knows that he wants to be independent, set sure. himself up with his brother Sid, and then they can do what they want. To me, that is absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
That a boy who's come from complete poverty in London and has been, first of all, on tour with Karno and is earning much more money than he's ever seen before in his life, and he knows that he's going to be independent soon. Then once he's in film, he knows that he wants to do it for himself and with the people he wants.
Sure.
It was just so quick. It's fantastic. And so he really knew where he was going.
Where Chaplin was going, at least on a business level, was toward the establishment of United Artists, a company set up in 1919 with Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, and D.W. Griffith, which, as its name suggested, would put the artists in control of their own work, a bold and radical move. UA released its founders' films alongside the work of such prestigious directors and stars as Buster Keaton, Rudolph Valentino, and Gloria Swanson to great critical and commercial acclaim. It could be argued that the building of United Artists was in itself the greatest work of its creators, who have been jointly credited with moving cinema into a new age of artistic achievement. D.W. Griffith in particular is regarded by many scholars as the father of modern film, but Chaplin's comedy, with its unique blend of personal pathos and anarchic physical politics, was every bit as influential in the development of this new medium. With his jerky bodily movements and automatized balletic grace, Chaplin seemed to embody the perils of the working man trapped within the machinery of the modern age. But this mechanical quality also reflected the nature of film itself, of the cranking cogs and wheels which would drive the celluloid flickering through the projector frame by frame. It was almost as if Chaplin, or more precisely, Chaplin's public persona, had been brought into existence by the birth of cinema. And there were times when the success of this public persona threatened to overshadow and even obliterate Chaplin's private life.
August the 9th, 1919. "My dear Sid, you are doubtless realizing who is addressing you. Yes, it really is your brother, Chaz. After all these years, but you must forgive me. The whole of my time is taken up with the movies. All the theatres feature my name in big letters. Charles Chaplin, here today. I tell you, in the country, I am a big box office attraction. And next year, I hope to make a bunch of dough. Your loving brother, Charlie.
And Chaplin was so famous that he would turn up to New York Station and the whole of Central Manhattan would be blocked on account of this. There were so many thousands of people. When he came back to England after the First World War, a headline in the Times said, "Crowds for Chaplin rival Armistice Day." Now, I mean, this is an astonishing level of celebrity.
As Mark Steele says, by the 20s, Chaplin's fame had expanded beyond all expectations, his rise mirroring the great explosion of cinema, which had already become the defining art form of the 20th century.
Now, I was doing a talk about Chaplin a little while ago, and someone got up and told me a great story that they'd been to a festival in Germany, an anti-fascist festival, where there was tens of thousands and this big sort of feel. I can imagine the sort of thing, like an anti-fascist Glastonbury. And they had bands playing and all this. And, you know, the average age, probably, this bloke describing it, so people are sort of teenagers, people in their early 20s. This was just a couple of years ago. And then one afternoon they showed The Great Dictator. And it was, they said it was fantastic, you know, the impact of it. People loved it. And there we are. Now, that's not bad if you make something and 65 years later it's having a direct impact on a whole generation of people, who none of which were born at the time you died even. I mean, that's not bad.
With his movies distributed worldwide, Chaplin received fan mail from the four corners of the globe, and his act and appearance were imitated on stage and screen by many who had never seen him in the flesh. For them, Chaplin existed only on celluloid, an iconic celebrity whose image was reproduced in a bizarre range of toys, souvenirs, and keepsakes. Over the years, these strange cultural artifacts would continue to multiply and mutate, as I discovered at the Chaplin Archive in Paris. Here, there are cabinets full of Chaplin paraphernalia. Wind-up dolls, trademark card games, soft toys, Christmas decorations, even cigarettes dubbed Tramp, the gentle smoke. There's a model of Charlie caught in the cogs of a machine in the manner of modern times, and even a collectible Charlie doll made by the Campbell's Soup Company. Some of it is magical, some of it's just plain mad, as archive director Kate Guillaume-Vache is acutely aware.
The thing I hate most is a celebrity duck.
Celebrity duck.
So it's a black duck with a little white tail, and it seems to be wearing a tuxedo, as they would call it, and it's got Chaplin's head with the orange beak. And we resisted making a license with these people for a while because we did think it was rather obscene. But then they had everybody else. You know, they had Laurel and Hardy and they had the Marx Brothers and they had all the other icons from the era. And we thought, well, maybe Charlie should be in there, because if he's not, it's strange. So there you go.
And it says on the packet, "Most all our worldly troubles are only drifting bubbles." I think that's a message we can all take home with us.
Lovely, isn't it?
The other thing that indicates the level of his popularity is how he was ultimately vilified in many ways for being so popular.
Mike Hammond from the University of Southampton.
He came in for a lot of criticism from conservative Americans, and the right was constantly hounded, first by the FBI from the early 1920s, and then he was hounded by the House of Un-American Activities Committee, and ultimately in 1952, when he went to go to the premiere of Limelight in London, his visa was revoked while he was at sea. He only returned much later in the early 1970s when he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Academy. So Chaplin's status, both in terms of his popularity, in terms of his recognition as an artist, and perhaps you're not really famous until the American right really hates you.
So here we have correspondence to Chaplin from assorted famous personages. This is a letter from Winston Churchill, dated the 9th of November 1952, private. My dear Mr. Chaplin, handwritten in ink pen and then typed, I have a private cinema at Chartwell, all right for some, and last Thursday had the great pleasure of seeing Limelight. I must congratulate you cordially on this masterpiece, which we all watched with mingled emotion and amusement. Mingled emotion and amusement. According to Plato, Socrates said that the genius of tragedy and comedy was essentially the same and that they should be written by the same author. I am glad you have had such a cordial welcome home in your hard-pressed native land. Yours, is that sincerely or?
I think so.
Yeah, yours sincerely, Winston Churchill, to Charles S. Chaplin, Esquire. And that's on Downing Street notepaper, of course, which is lovely. Look at that. That has a Downing Street, it's a Prime Minister's seal. 10 Downing Street, Whitehall. Wow. And Truman Capote.
Truman Capote was a great friend of Lady Chaplin's. But it's
but
about...
Again, this is handwritten by Capote.
This is handwritten, 17th of April, 1965. Perry and Dick were executed at midnight last Tuesday. I was there. I kissed them goodbye. It was an unbearable experience, and I feel physically and emotionally shattered, far more than I ever envisioned. Yes, I wanted it to end, but I only hope God can forgive me. They both behaved with great dignity and were very brave. Perhaps someday I will be able to tell you about it. Charlie said the book would bring me great joy. I'm afraid he was wrong. Truly, I am heartbroken. My love to you both always, Truman.
Wow. That is extraordinary.
Isn't it?
Perry and Dick were executed at midnight last Tuesday. And I feel physically and emotionally shattered. That's very interesting, though. Charlie said the book would bring me great joy. I'm afraid he was wrong. Mm. Truly, I'm heartbroken. And, of course, that, you know, proved to be the case because he never completed another work. That is extraordinary.
In every level of society, Chaplin was known, admired, even adored. Around the world, everyone knew his name, from Gandhi to the Crown Prince of Siam, from the great thinker Einstein to the great filmmaker Eisenstein. Contemplating Charlie's appeal, Eisenstein dubbed him the living incarnation of Christ's simple man, comparing the figure of the little tramp with Parsifal, the pure fool who inherits Christ's grail in Wagner's celebrated opera. Similarly, in the poem Chaplin-esque, Hart Crane admired the radiant goodness which transforms comedy into communion. The moon in lonely alleys, he writes, makes a grail of laughter of an empty ash can. For Chaplin's daughter Geraldine, however, the magic of Charlie's celebrity was less religious and rather closer to home.
All of us were always very conscious that our father was Charlie Chaplin and that that was something incredibly important. I mean, we used to see, from the time I can remember, we used to see Charlie Chaplin films, always, always. And I remember one day, my brother Michael and I, we must have been about 4 and 5, we went down the driveway, which was a tremendous adventure, down to the gates. And outside the gates, it was the first time we'd ever been outside the gates of my father's house. And there was this lady passing, and we were real brats. And we went up to her and we said, we're Charlie Chaplin's children. And she looked down and she said, who's he? And this terrible shock. I remember, you don't know who Charlie Chaplin is? And of course, she obviously did, but she thought, oh, those disgusting little brats.
Precocious kids aside, everyone had heard of Chaplin, who had hundreds of songs composed and dances invented in his honour. Meanwhile, Chaplin impersonators sprung up around the world, their appearances ranging from 1916's Charlie at the Sydney Show to a wave of Oriental Charlies in 1950s Hong Kong. There's even newsreel footage of women doing the Charlie Chaplin walk in the improbable surroundings of Stalin's Russia, not to mention Siev's Chaplin-esque riff in the Bollywood mega-hit Mr. India. Chaplin biographer David Robinson recites this tribute to the walk that wooed the world.
Since Charlie Chaplin became all the craze, everyone copies his funny old ways. They copy his hat and the curl in his hair. His moustache is something you cannot compare. They copy the ways he makes love to the girls. His method is a treat. There's one thing about Charlie they will never get, and that is the shoes on his feet. Shuffling along, they're acting like a rabbit. When you see Charlie Chaplin, you can't help but get the habit. First they stumble over both their feet, swing their sticks, then look up and down the street. Fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers, all your wife's relations and a half a dozen others, in London, Paris or New York, everybody does that Charlie Chaplin walk.
The everyman comedy of Chaplin's lovable tramp, with his goofy gait and mischievous persistence, won the hearts of ordinary filmgoers the world over. But in the lofty echelons of art, Chaplin was being hailed as far more than merely an entertainer. Off-screen, his high-profile admirers included the writer James Agee, Tristan Tzara's Dadaists, the Surrealists, and the proponents of Russian constructivism. For these radicals, the anarchic antics of Charlie's Clown held profound political significance, portraying the absurd predicament of man in the modern age and dramatising the triumph of the outsider with a humour which was as subversive as it was silly. In the archives of Paris, we find an extraordinary series of drawings and illustrations in which artists such as the Cubist painter Ferdinand Léger deconstruct and disassemble the constituent parts of the tramp. What's most remarkable about these designs is the degree to which the iconic elements of Chaplin's appearance remain indestructible, no matter how far removed they are from reality. Like all truly timeless trademarks, Chaplin's image is immediately recognisable, even when reduced to the most acute abstractions.
You've got two sets of pictures, one of them black and white, one of them in colour. It's the recognisable Chaplin little tramp image, but deconstructed in this, you know, with straight lines and very angular, harsh blacks and whites, and yet it is still clearly recognisable as the little tramp.
Here we've got some pictures by Blumenfeld, Erwin Blumenfeld, 1920s as well, Chaplin Collage 1921, where there's just all these sort of mad mixture of things, and Chaplin crucified in the middle.
But again, what you actually have there is you have a cross. But then it's just simply, at some point on the cross, you have a bowler hat and a moustache, and yet that is clearly recognisable as Chaplin. It's a very, very small amount of detail required to indicate that it's Chaplin.
And it's a watercolour in which we see a figure of Chaplin. His eyes are closed and he's actually been crucified on the cross.
Jennifer Wilde from the University of Iowa.
But what's also interesting is that we see Chaplin used as a way to connect with the movement Dada. It's almost fusing both of them together, as though if you're a Dadaist, you're also a big fan of Chaplin. And so I think Chaplin here, for someone like Blumenfeld, who used Chaplin and fused him with a sort of image of Christ, that became quite a political gesture. But it also signified that Chaplin was a figure which the Dadaists were very interested in, and a figure that, who could express their own political instincts, their humor, that Chaplin was an icon for them, someone who was very representative of how themselves felt. Chaplin's films arrive in Europe almost, I think, 1 year before basically the Dada movement gets going in Zurich. And what's very interesting, if we look at the figure of Tristan Tzara, who was one of the principal creators and leaders of the Dada movement being created in Zurich in 1916, Chaplin's films arriving in 1915 in Europe. So if we follow Tristan Tzara, who becomes really the figurehead of Dada movement when he moves from Zurich to Paris in 1920, we see specific things happening with Tzara's use of Charlie Chaplin. What becomes even more interesting is that after Tzara arrives in Paris and the Dadaists decide to have another official Dada event, Tzara pulls a really interesting move, and that is when he contacts a local newspaper, and about 3 or 4 days before the Dadaists have a great literary event, Tzara publishes in Le Journal du Peuple. It actually advertises in this newspaper that Chaplin's going to be there and he's going to be reading with the Dadaists. And of course, this is completely false. Of course, it drew a large number of people, and historians have described this event as a very raucous, violent event, because the people who had come to see Chaplin and not to see the Dadaists were very disappointed. What's interesting is that when Zara writes initially to the Parisians and includes this poster. Oh, these are new members of the Dadaists, including Charlie Chaplin. Breton writes back to Zara, actually, and says, and in disbelief, saying that this is a delicious surprise, but of course it's not true. But there's a question mark there. And so Breton himself is actually very curious that, and very seduced by the idea of Charlie Chaplin actually having joined the Dadaists, because I think in their mind, Charlie Chaplin was a completely natural Dadaist. He was someone who just possessed a Dadaistic spirit. So without Chaplin, they may have not have had these kinds of coups with popularity or with the mass public.
Although Chaplin experienced huge success in America, he also made enemies within the government, who also viewed him as a highly subversive and somewhat uncontrollable figure. During his years in the US, Chaplin was dogged, as are so many modern-day celebrities, by a series of sex scandals, kicking off with his high-profile divorce from Lolita Louise Chaplin in the mid-20s. The lurid details of this case, which rapidly became a best-selling pamphlet, included accusations that throughout their two-year marriage, Charlie had demanded that his wife submit to, perform, and commit such acts and things for the gratification of defendants' abnormal, unnatural, perverted, and degenerate sexual desires as to be revolting, indecent, and immoral, including, get this, repeated demands for the sex perversion defined by Section 288 of the Penal Code of California. These and other allegations of moral misconduct delighted the surrealists, who leapt to Chaplin's defence, proclaiming him a bold and honest adversary of hypocritical middle-class decorum. To them, Charlie was a genuinely free spirit, unbound by the staid conventions of conservative life, and his body, the subject of so much public scandal, was at the heart of his radical charm, transforming itself into something more than mere flesh and blood, as Chaplin's screen persona broke down the boundaries between man and machine. Moving to the mechanical rhythms of modern life, Chaplin's screen image became a source of fascination for those artists who saw his antics not as funny, but futuristic. Tom Gunning from the University of Chicago.
One of the main things that they recognized and that they capitalized on was the idea that Chaplin's body was partly like a machine, that partly what he would do in kind of evoking the modern life of the body was to kind of stage almost a battle between the desire to make the body more like a machine, make it more responsive, more predictable, more regular, and then all the demands of the body to move freely, to react to sexual stimulation or to digestion or all those things. And so that he had this enormous interest in kind of both of these poles. Now, the modern artists, particularly the Cubists and the Russian Constructivists, saw in Chaplin literally a kind of new geometry, you know, that he was hard-edged, that he was sharp angles, that he moved as though he were a kind of puppet. Ferdinand Léger, the great Cubist painter, in fact, made a puppet of Chaplin, which he would animate and which would move, and he actually made a film in which it kind of comes apart and then comes back together. Likewise, the Russian artists were fascinated with this kind of sense of Chaplin as part of a machine, partly because, of course, the Russian artists were undergoing this kind of romance with the machine, and they saw Chaplin as somebody who would lead the way to a kind of new experience of the body that would resemble the machine. Now, Chaplin's own attitude towards that was probably more ambivalent than the artists were, that for him, I think, usually when something becomes a machine, it's funny because it's unnatural. There's a sequence in one of his last silent films, The Circus, where he pretends to be a mechanical man in a funhouse precisely to hide from a policeman. And it is extraordinary how he conveys his sense of being a machine man rather than a living man. I mean, I've watched it, dozens of times. And there is a transformation. I see it happen. He becomes inanimate. He becomes mechanical. He becomes a thing rather than a person. Although at the same time, you're aware of this kind of enormous skill and wit that is managing this transformation.
What Chaplin shows us is the impact of modernity on the human body. His comedy is often described as full of bits of business, and he never stops. His body is almost out of control. But one way that I believe that the modernists were attracted by this is that it also seems like a kind of neurotic character, a character who is really completely punished, but in another way, reacting against the impact and the shocks of modern life.
One of the things that Chaplin would do was to take an object that had an obvious kind of utilitarian purpose and transform it into something else, something that we wouldn't associate it with. I mean, the most classic example, of course, here is the eating of the shoe in the Gold Rush. Now, that is primarily an expression of pathos. People are starving. They're having to chew on leather. It's something that, in fact, starving people have done. Chaplin not only is able to make that a sort of black comedy, but also a kind of poetry, because he looks at the shoe and it isn't just like, oh God, I've got to eat this. He treats it partly as a turkey. He twirls the shoelaces as though they're spaghetti. He picks out the tacks in the shoe and acts as though they're wishbones. You know, he constantly looks at things and makes almost a metaphor, a visual metaphor, in the way that he handles them, transforming them into something else. And that is exactly what the Surrealists loved, because the Surrealists were interested in the way that modern life was not just a realm of quotidian, pedestrian, rational purposes, but interpenetrated with dreams and with imagination and with humor. And that Chaplin, in a way, is the perfect surrealist from that point of view, because he was somebody who was able to find these kind of dreamlike associations. Hilarious, sometimes angry, sometimes very pointed, sometimes violent, but always transforming and expressing this kind of freedom of the imagination. There's a wonderful drawing of Chaplin by Marc Chagall, the Russian Jewish painter who then came to France, which shows Chaplin with kind of angel wings on him. And my wonderful colleague Yuri Sivian has done a terrific analysis of this painting, pointing out how there is indeed an important Chaplin film, a couple of them actually, where he actually appears in angel wings as a kind of comic angel. And one of the things is that, you know, he immediately scratches his wings. You know, that on the one hand, we have this image of the ethereal and it becomes immediately bodily, you know, an itch. Chagall used this image of combining a man and an angel in this way that looks rather poetic and surreal, but it is actually an image that almost comes directly from Chaplin.
In 1947, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and screenwriter James Agee, who wrote The African Queen, penned a screenplay called The Tramp's New World, which placed Chaplin's little tramp amid the desolate surroundings of post-apocalyptic New York. Agee's story outline, perhaps the first anti-nuke film, begins, "Without warning, a superatomic bomb is dropped, but there is one survivor, the tramp. In one long solo, he wanders the absolute desolation of New York, examining civilization as it looked in the fraction of a second before it ceased to live." For Agee, Chaplin's tramp was an emblematic survivor, somehow untouched by the destruction of American society. For the government, however, Chaplin was actively conspiring to bring civilization down around him. Indeed, trumped-up charges of communist sympathies and yet more moral scandals made Chaplin such a subversive figure that in the early 1950s his visa was revoked whilst he was travelling abroad. Unable to return to the US, Chaplin decamped with his wife Una and children to Switzerland, from whence he surveyed the depressing wasteland of modern America.
This is one of Charlie's few letters.
So this is Chaplin writing to Agee on the 16th of December 1953. "Firstly, I am so glad to be out of that stinkpot country of yours. I should have done it in 1930 when I was over there the last time. I never really wanted to come back then, but the fates knew best, because I would never have met Una and our five children. To be over here, away from that torrid atmosphere, is like stepping out of the death house into the free sunlight. Occasionally someone sends us a New York Tribune. Its dark news makes me shudder. It's nothing else but dullest vomit all over the front page and the belly aching about the charity they are giving to the world. Oh, what a stinkpot country. As the Negro says about living in Paris, coloured folks is quality here. So I say about Europe, Charlie's the tops.
That's because they obviously, I mean, you know, when he was in Europe, he was feted and not in the States. And it must have been a lovely contrast.
There is incredible, anger in that, isn't there? I mean, there is really, I mean, when he says the phrase stinkpot country, not once, but twice, it's not funny. It's quite bitter.
James Agee, of course, is a really interesting figure because he comes a little bit later and was partly involved in kind of almost, renewing the interest in Chaplin in the 1940s. Not that it had ever totally disappeared, but Agee was a film critic as well as a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. So he was very aware of cinema both as a practitioner and as a critic, and he felt very strongly that Chaplin was the most extraordinary artist probably that cinema had ever produced. But furthermore, and this I know is one of the most interesting things that Agee did in defining Chaplin, was that he had discovered him as a child in the teens, when Agee himself was a child, and during this enormous Chaplin craze that happened in the teens. And in his novel, which is basically autobiographical, A Death in the Family, Agee described that kind of childhood experience of watching Chaplin. One of the very first moments in Agee's novel is a description of his family, his father kind of announcing that they're going to go off and see Chaplin. And it's a nice bit of writing, of course, but also it's, I think, a kind of document of this kind of ambivalence that that Chaplin generated. So I'll just read this here. At supper that night, as so many times before, his father said, "Well, suppose we go to the picture show." "Oh, Jay," his mother said, "that horrid little man." "What's wrong with him?" his father asked, not because he didn't know what she would say, but so that she would say it. "He's so nasty," she said, as she always did, "so vulgar, with his nasty little cane, hooking up skirts and things, and that nasty little walk." Now, the little man, and it's interesting that Agee didn't even have to give his name immediately, but the little man, he was often called the little fellow, and the cane, of course, tipped everything off that they're talking about going to see Chaplin. And, of course, the father and the son are great fans, but the mother protests her objection. And it's one of the best witnesses I think we have, even though it was written later, of what it was like to be fascinated by Chaplin, somewhat shocked by Chaplin, and totally amused is almost not even the word, sent into hilarity, but also this very strong sense of identification that children and, well, almost everyone could have with this kind of predicaments.
Ultimately, perhaps the greatest indication of Chaplin's fame and of the radical power of his art was the degree of hostility which he provoked from the authorities. As Mike Hammond says, you're not really famous until the American right really hates you. Charlie Chaplin died on Christmas Day 1977, a few years after a long overdue rehabilitation in the US. His wife Una was inundated with letters and telegrams, which I was privileged to read in the Paris archive. Letters of condolence from the great and the good, including John Steinbeck, Arthur Miller, John Gielgud, Lord Mountbatten, Truman Capote, Marcel Marceau, the list goes on and on. Chaplin biographer David Robinson.
The tributes that were paid when he died, they came from across the world. I particularly liked Federico Fellini, the great Italian director, who said that he was a sort of Adam from whom we are all descended.
These are just various telegrams that were sent to Lady Chaplin when her husband died. This is Richard Attenborough. "For me, he will always be my idol. Through his films, he was the reason for my wanting to be an actor. You will know, therefore, just how precious to me was the occasion of the opening of the BAFTA headquarters when the royal family were able to present him with his fellowship. He was a genius, beloved by all mankind, and there must be countless people who are forever in your debt for all that you contributed to his life and work. Petula Clark, Marcel Marceau.
And so Marcel Marceau telegram says, our heart is bleeding, but Charlie Chaplin will leave forever the world and us. Stop. Deepest feelings to you and your family.
David Niven,
our fondest love to you all.
Mm-hmm. Milos Forman.
Oh, Milos Forman, wow.
Dear Mrs. Una, if there's anything I could do for you, please let me know.
I suppose, finally, you might say this is the gift of a very great actor. I know that when he died, Laurence Olivier, who was not inclined to pay easy compliments to fellow performers, did say he was the greatest actor of us all.
Today, 30 years after his death, there are street kids in Brazilian favelas aping Chaplin's gestures and mannerisms, and Indian advertising companies shooting boot polish commercials featuring Chaplin imitators. The little tramp image is more than just a movie character. It's a mass-produced trademark which has come to define and embody the very nature of celebrity and modernity, an instantly recognisable icon which means something different to each new viewer. I used to think of Chaplin as a rank sentimentalist, but through the prism of the surrealists, the modernists and the cubists, I've come to realise that his work was edgy, angular, subversive, anything but soft.
We see Chaplin circulating in iconography, in, you know, pieces of artwork, as well as in poems, as well as in, you know, writing. He's a point of exchange for all of these artists. And so what I really think is that Chaplin became a model through which the Dadaists could then imagine an international circulation of their own art practice. And what a better way to do that but by sort of tracing the flow of Chaplin, who was performing and circulating on an international scale very quickly.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking.
Chaplin's image and his influence on the arts and on culture at large is absolutely enormous. And I mean, there's no question that everyone from Eisenstein to Jerry Lewis, which is quite a range in terms of personality, was influenced by Chaplin and adores him. And I think that it's really, at base, it's because he showed how in the new century, the 20th century, the century of mass media, it was possible to represent a lowly everyman figure, and everyone got the point. I mean, Chaplin, Mickey Mouse are probably the two great everyman figures that everybody gets, and everyone smiles when they appear.
You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile.
David Thompson was the final voice you heard there in the final part of Chaplin, Celebrity and Modernism, presented by Mark Commode and produced by Fiona Kroll.